Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, I don't know what I don't know what the answer I'd be looking for there. In fact, you can shout yes. Fantastic. Good. Thank you. Thank you for coming along to this Open Tech 2009. This is the session Community and Democracy in Hijacked Space. Plus, does freedom of information work? You bet. I'm Dave Green. I'll be chairing this session and the next one. Unless, of course, they don't go very well, in which case, please refer to me by my stage name, Danny O'Brien. Our first speaker is it's from the Space Hijackers. Are people generally familiar with the Space Hijackers? A show of hands if you are. That's good. For those of you who aren't, I copy this off their website. They're a group dedicated to battling the constant oppressive encroachment onto public spaces of by institutions, corporations, and urban planners. And they have a disclaimer that says, all of the views and actions on their website are completely ludicrous, and they actually believe the opposite. So please bear that in mind. While you welcome, in a completely genuine and not opposite-believing way, Robin from the Space Hijackers.
So, hello. My name's Robin, I'm from Space Hijackers. It's going to be a bit bandit-ish because we've got this wireless mouse and I'm desperately have to kind of lean over it to try and make it work, but it seems to I think we're winning. Space Hijackers is a group which we've been together about 10 years now, and we do lots of kind of, I don't know, artistic activist sort of stuff. Mainly relating about kind of living in a city and kind of what it is to live in the city and kind of who controls the way that we live and the kind of things that we do. It basically started off, I used to skateboard with a bunch of friends and we'd get in lots of trouble with the police and then it kind of, and do really dumb things. And they would kind of develop from there. There was a really clear thing I remember once where down at Liverpool Street Station, there's a little brass line that runs down the floor. And on one side of this line is public land and the pavement. On the other side is the... Yep. And on the other side, there we are. On the other side of this this brass line is private land. It's the Broadgate Centre, and so we used to skateboard there. It was great. There were steps and blocks and bits and bobs and the other. And depending on which, we kind of found this out from one of the police one day. But depending on which security turned up, you know, the laws changed depending on which side of this brass line you're on. And so if the police turned up, we'd jump onto the kind of private land side of it, and. And then the police couldn't really bust you unless the Broadgate Centre had phoned them to ask you to remove you for trespassing. And if the Broadgate security turned up, you'd step on the other side of this brass line where they couldn't touch you because it was public land and they had no jurisdiction over it. And so we'd spend all afternoon, depending on kind of who came to bust us, just stepping either side of this brass line again. and that was fun. And so it kind of gradually developed from there. I went off to art school. Various other people kind of started, I don't know, holding big illegal raves and things like that, and it kind of grew from that into the kind of monster that it's become now. Basically, the way it works now, we have our website, which you'll be seeing a bit of in a moment, and we plan everything online. There's a group of us, probably about kind of 30 to 40 people, meet up once a month, get quite drunk, and kind of vent anger of you know, what's bothering us in London at the moment. And then we get together and we see what we can do about it. I think a lot of what we do is about this idea of kind of taking an active role in the city that you live in. So for example, you get a lot of kind of like art, you know, when people send artists out to go and kind of, you know, fix rundown estates or whatever, they kind of parachute in these magical artists and then they wave their magic wands of art and fix stuff and then leave. And we're kind of coming from a very different angle, much more that, you know, this is where we live and these are the things that bother us, and so we're gonna try and do something about it. And so I figured probably the best way to describe what we do is to go through a couple of our projects. The one I'd start with was one we did just a week or so ago with this character called, I don't know if anyone knows the Reverend Billy. And the Reverend Billy runs the Church of Stop Shopping, or Church of Life After Shopping, I think, yeah. And basically, we're mainly based in the East End around Whitechapel, and our latest addition to the wonders of Whitechapel is this Starbucks, which we've had a kind of campaign of harassment against ever since it opened up. And we've done various things, bits and bobs, like we used to, we'd go up and stick these nipple tassels on the mermaid, the Starbucks logo, in case anyone didn't know, used to have nipples and a belly button and a belly and, like, you know, these legs, and gradually as they kind of expanded and became this kind of world-dominating force that they are now, they kind of toned down the logo, especially as they were going into the kind of, you know, the Midwest, and now she's kind of got no nipples and you know, not particularly, you know, particularly mermaid-like anymore. So we'd go back and we'd stick the nipples back on, or we'd go and do various other projects. But we decided with the Reverend. The Reverend Billy runs, he's running for New York mayor, actually, at the moment. But we'd go there and we'd cause a little bit of chaos with the Reverend. We figured that, the Starbucks, the way that Starbucks moving in, and there's lots of the other little coffee stores are doing much worse now. Starbucks, I guess people know a lot about Starbucks, but they have a tactic called clustering, where they basically move in loads of stores into an area and undercut so that they can put other little businesses out of business. Or they'll go up to small coffee shops and offer the landlord twice the rent just to kick them out, or they'll, you know, they're generally not nice people. So we thought, you know, this is Starbucks moving into the East End was pretty much, you know, the beginning of the end for the East End. So we thought we'd have a funeral. So it started off, we made a coffin and started off at the Starbucks in Spitalfields, where we kind of, along with a big samba band, a full funeral procession and a kind of gospel choir and reverend, kind of went into this Starbucks in Spitalfields Market. And the Reverend does this kind of, is this big evangelical preacher. And so he started his thing. Eventually, you know, he was up on the manager's screaming and shouting at us. He was up on the counter trying to exorcise the demons from the tills. We're kind of carrying this kind of coffin around, like, you know, with this big, and then this like booming death march samba band outside. And yeah, you know, it caused a fair amount of chaos at that point. So we thought probably best to, you know, we thought we'd make our way through there, like, you know, following the spread of the kind of the evil mermaid through to Whitechapel. And so made our way through the kind of regenerated Spitalfields Market, you know, which is now 2/3 of it been destroyed and turned into office blocks. And on our way to Whitechapel. As with most of our actions, the police turned up. They're not our best. They're not our best friends. But this time it was curiously useful. For a start, there's probably about 100 of us walking down the road. The police blocked all the roads, blocked all the traffic, so we could have this funeral procession down the middle of the road. Then there's this switchover between the city police and the Met. Kind of as you leave Spitalfields and you leave the city, they switch teams. And obviously to kind of make it sound like it was important for them to kind of like pile out six riot vans, there was this kind of Chinese whispers between the two police forces. So by the time we hit the Met, they'd been told that we'd already been into the Starbucks in Spitalfields, trashed the place, that there was 150 of us rampaging through the streets. And so by the time they arrived, there was like helicopters, so we carried on our way down towards the Whitechapel Starbucks. Where we found that the Met had already closed the store because they were so anxious of this riot that was about to kick off. And so they'd thrown everyone out of the shop, told them that it was an angry mob coming to get them, and shut down the store, at which point obviously our gospel choir turned up. And then we started serving nice cup of tea and a sit down. And it was all in all quite beautiful. The store was closed for the rest of the day. We gave out lots of nice fair trade tea. The Reverend, you know, got to preach to the masses. The police all kind of got a nice cup of tea. And everyone went home happy, except for the boss of Starbucks, which is good. Let me kind of scrolling down. Oh, where is it? Over there. Back to projects. We have a lot of interactions with the police. Generally, it's a bit of a kind of love-hate relationship. They don't really, I don't know, we have this thing called the FIT team, which you may have been reading about in the papers recently, but the Forward Intelligence Team, which kind of follow you around and, you know, and kind of build up little profiles on you, and, you know, they kind of, if I, you know, go to the loo in a protest, like quite often, because I don't know, a few of us have got known now. So for example, May Day a few years ago, I was given a personal escort of two policemen to keep me safe for the day, which basically meant, you know, because they were worried for my safety. And so two policemen followed me for the entire day, like even to the point of like standing outside a cubicle while I had a shit, you know. It was like, you know, and literally standing there in the, you know, in the toilets waiting just in case I tried to do a runner or something like this. And they quite often, you know, they kind of come in and they've got their usual tactics of, you know, as you've all seen, of kettling people and this and that, the other. And so we did something last year where we tried to use this. Oh, here we go. Try again. That's not going to work. All right. Well, I can tell you about it. It's easy peasy. How do we go back on this? No. Okay, well, I'll tell you about it. May Day 1708 it was. Actually, there's probably a link on the front page that works properly. And basically, this was May Day 1708 was the last ever Mayfair in Mayfair, which is where it gets its name from. Down we go. Is this one going to work? Yes, bingo. So yeah, it was the last 300th anniversary of the last ever Mayfair in Mayfair last year. So we thought we would reenact this with the help of the Metropolitan Police. And so we put out these flyers. It was the Space Hijackers and the Metropolitan Police present May Day 2008. And printed up thousands and thousands of these things, handed out. And basically it was in Act One, you know, the Space Hijackers would put on a reenactment of the traditional Mayfair in Mayfair, you know, and there'd be kind of drinking and debauchery and general chaos. And then in Act Two, the police would reenact the closing down of the Mayfair. and so we got the mob together, all got our kind of our 18th century, you know, our clothes on, and led everyone into the heart of Mayfair. There was probably, I don't know, 300-400 people. And it was a beautiful afternoon, and you know, everyone got totally trashed. We had bales of hay there. We had a big kind of like phallic kind of maypole, all sorts of bits and bobs. And the beauty was that the police, because they were kind of, because they don't really like playing games, right? And they don't really like joining in. And so this is me in a rather fetching Marie Antoinette outfit. And so the police were under strict instructions not to shut down the party. we went up to them, and it was getting on for about kind of 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was going up to some of the kind of Officer Steve Discombe, member of the FIT team. And I was like, Steve, come on, you know, we've been here for hours now. Like, the sound system's running out. And I was like, when are you going to kick us out? And he was like, we're under strict instructions not to kick you out. Well, they'd have said no, though. I'm sure they'd have just said no. Oh no, totally. But I mean, I think you kind of hit like definitely we had a big discussion with a lot of the actions about kind of who it affects, right? And especially when we're doing things in stores, in the, you know, the last thing we want to do is piss off the guy who's getting paid minimum wage, you know, in the shop. You know, mostly you want to annoy the people that own the shop, you know, and especially with all the actions, like in Mayfair, for example, all the actual. The local shops and stuff like that, you kind of, you know, we went in and the bit around, I think Shepherd's Market was where we held it. And there's lots of kind of little independent, you know, like we're definitely, the kind of the way that we kind of plan it and the way that we kind of go in there is very much so that we don't piss off the locals, you know, like you don't want to piss off the locals. I mean, mainly with this one, we wanted to annoy the police, which, you know, because previous May Days, they'd been so heavy-handed with everything, you know? And so the plan was, you know, what can we do that is going to annoy the police mostly? And, you know, everyone that lived in the area, we're giving out free drinks, we're giving out food to everyone and all these sort of things, but we're not going to ask for permission to do this, you know? Mainly because I think as well, especially May Day, you should never have to ask for permission. You know, it's a kind of day where, you know, where the whole point of May Day is that you don't have to ask for permission. So So it carried on like this, and it got to the point where the police were refusing to, they were like, we are under, whatever happens, we will not shut this party down. And I was like, well, this isn't going to work. So we ended up, I was like, right, okay, look, we're all going to go to the pub, but you've got to follow us really angrily. And at which point they were like, all right, yeah, we can do that. We can definitely do that. And so we all kind of like left en masse, and then the police like all put on, they switch between kind of these yellow and blue outfits and stuff like that. And when they turn from yellow into blue, it's time to kind of get the hell out of there. And so they all took off their yellow coats and kind of like stormed along after us. And it kind of worked. I mean, there's a few things we've done on a similar vein, but this, there was one, we held a game of, I don't know, I'm going on too long. I've got a little bit more. There was one we did a few years ago in Niketown, where we were running this thing called the Multinational Corporate Games. And the idea was that we had all these big kind of, multinational companies that were kind of gradually taking over. And we wanted to kind of slightly, reclaim this space a bit and also, and also have fun. A lot of it's about enjoying ourselves. So we organized this this set of games during the European Social Forum, where we were going to hold an Olympics inside chain stores. And I think the first game was called Find the Gap, and it was playing Sardines. I don't know if anyone knows the game Sardines, but we're playing this inside gaps. So someone would go in and hide in the shop somewhere, and then we'd all go in looking for them. And then if you found them, you have to join them in the hiding place, right? Until the last person finds you, sort of thing. Obviously, the security join in on this one as well. Which is nice. And then we played bingo in McDonald's, I think, where you queue up and you had a little McDonald's menu with kind of like, and so as people would all, it's Big Mac and fries, and you'd be like, Big Mac, yeah, I got that. And it was like, chocolate milkshake, strawberry, no, hold on. And eventually someone would get bingo, and we'd all kind of like flood back out the store, and the store would be half empty because it was full of all of us. But anyway, the day kind of culminated in this game of British Bulldog inside Niketown. Now, everyone loves British Bulldog. It's banned in pretty much every playground in the country. But basically, the game is, I don't know if everyone that doesn't know, there's some muggins stands in the middle of the playground, and then the whole school line up on the other side, and then he shouts, or she shouts, British Bulldog 1, 2, 3, and then all the other kids run across and flatten them. But the idea is that hopefully this poor kid in the middle catches someone, and if you catch him, then they're on your side. And then as they come back for the second attack, there's two of you to try and get them, and it gradually builds up until there's the other small kid, who's a bit dodgy, and the whole school trying to get him as he comes through. So we thought this would be a perfect game to play inside Niketown. And so we kind of strolled in there, and I was the idiot in the middle. And everyone's kind of mulling along one side. And by this point, the game has been going on, and the police were kind of onto it. And so there were 6 riot vans parked outside the front of Niketown, and this kind of line of police along the front. But obviously they didn't know, who was there to play British Bulldog and who was there just to buy clothes. So they kind of had to let everyone in. And they obviously, if you had dreadlocks, you weren't allowed in the store that day. But so we go in and everyone would start milling on one side. And we picked a side and they all start looking at the trainers and this and that and the other. And then I'm in the middle and I was like, British Bulldog, 1, 2, 3. And then they start running, and then the security start running, and then the police start running. And everyone's trying to catch everyone. And obviously the rules of the game are, once you're caught, you're on their team, right? So the police are there, and they've kind of grabbed me and dragging me off. But then I see my friend Pete running past, so I've like grabbed him. And the policeman's like, what are you doing? It's like, it's all right, mate, I'm on your side. And he was like, And so then there's this like conga of activists being like dragged out of this store by policemen. And the beauty was that they were forced into playing this game, and it forced into this kind of different set of rules that doesn't work the way that they expect. And so I think that's a lot of what we do is about kind of like resetting the rules the way that we want them to work, as opposed to kind of necessarily, listening to how this space should operate, or how this kind of city should operate. And I think the idea being that the more that we can kind of create the city that we want, then, the more that we can become active in that, then the more kind of of a nicer city it'll be, and encouraging other people to do that as opposed to just purely listening to us, you know. So there we go.
Thank you. Did I use your real name earlier?
It's all right. That's fine.
What's your sticker say? It's Bristly.
Bristly Pioneer. That's my agent.
Bristly Pioneer. I think we have time for some questions now, particularly if they're loud or if they're quiet and you can't hear them, we'll repeat them. Do we have any questions? And you're not allowed to answer any questions involving tanks?
Yes, still on bail for that one.
For impersonating a police officer?
Yeah, drove a tank into the middle of the G20 demonstrations.
Don't say anymore.
That's pretty much all I can say at the moment. But yes, that was fun.
Any questions? Put your hand up if you've got a question. Otherwise, I'm going to jump in. People will also know you for the London Underground Tea Parties. Was that you guys?
Yeah, that was us as well. Yeah.
And that was before flash mobs were like even had a name. question on that, Francis.
Yeah, I want to spend a bit of time talking about Starbucks
Right.
Well, so Starbucks changing to all fair trade coffee.
Yeah. Starbucks change. I mean, the thing is, like, yeah, they are. You know, the thing that annoys me the most about it is the fact that, like, for years Starbucks did their, because they didn't want to be involved in fair trade because, you know, they were too busy suing Ethiopia and things like that. They had their own thing. I think it was Commitments to Origins, they called it, which was fair trade that they would monitor themselves because they didn't believe that anyone else could do it as well as them. And then obviously, you know, consumer pressures built up. So now they're you know, serving fair trade coffee. But I think even now, it's not even that, like, in the cup, they just sell bagged fair trade coffee. I don't know if they even actually sell it. Yeah, but I mean, I remember like 10 years ago, they were saying, I remember speaking to them saying, well, why don't you do fair trade? And they're like, the things we can't get the supply. And I was like, you know, of all the people, like, you know, but yeah, they were, I mean, they do it because they're under pressure, you know, and they do it because people harass them all the time. But I wouldn't, you know, I certainly wouldn't mistake that for any sort of like philanthropic sort of gesture of theirs. You know, they're just evil and don't go there.
Any more questions? But just to follow up, you're not necessarily campaigning for Starbucks to be a better...
We'd quite like to shut down more ethically.
Yeah. You just prefer to see.
But I think as much as well, it's not even so much just about the coffee. It's the fact that, like, they, you know, they have this kind of like pseudo counterculture kind of thing that they put out. But it's just identical stores across the country, you know, and there's no, you know, it's like this pretense at this kind of local kind of like cafe culture sort of thing. But you know, they're the kind of the battered sofas are the same the world over, you know, which is a bit dull.
Another question.
What's the difference between Starbucks and
another
chain like Pret?
Yeah, no, I mean, Pret as well. Pret are owned by McDonald's. They're also pretty nasty, as it goes. Well, we focus on that one because it's round the corner from my house. And I just don't like it being there. So we generally harass that one as much as possible.
Question there?
Yeah, I mean,
does everyone hear the question? I'm repeating it. It's are you basically situationists? Is that fair? And can you explain what situationism is?
Okay, right. Well, there's no such thing as situationism. Is the first thing, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, there's a group back in, you know, in Paris, 1968, causing trouble, called the Situationist International, and I think they were definitely a big influence on us. Them, Reclaim the Streets, all sorts of kind of, you know, characters like that. And I think there's a certain line of, you know, kind of like political activism, you know, which involves not just marching from A to B to listen to Tony Benn, that, you know, that we definitely support. I think, you know, we definitely, this idea of trying to kind of raise question and kind of act as this like little, I don't know, like pan-like character, kind of like, you know, kicking up a bit of a storm and then seeing what happens, you know. Yeah, you know, and also wit kind of protects us from getting hit too hard by the police as well, I think, you know. Like, I think the funnier you are, the kind of the harder they find it to kind of like plow in, you know, which is good.
And is there a kind of implied political agenda to situationism?
They were pretty political. They were, in fact, gradually, they started off as an art movement and then gradually kicked everyone out, you know, as they were kind of, you know, became more and more hard until there was just a couple of them left, pretty much.
A reluctant question there from the looks of it. That's what kind of press coverage have you had?
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot. We've had quite a lot, especially when we drive around in the tank, it seems. Like the best one being, we took the tank down to the Dicey Arms Fair a couple of years ago, and we're quite good friends with the woman who works for the kind of local BBC London presenter. And so she did this whole report about, you know, the arms fair. We were basically auctioning this tank outside an arms fair to activists to drive through the police because, you know, it was just a legitimate business. And it doesn't matter what, you know, people were doing with the weapons afterwards. You know, we were just businessmen. And we got onto the local news, except that she like, accidentally, my friend, yeah, it was Pete, Agent Greenman, was on there talking about how great it was to be an arms dealer. And then she put Dicey representative underneath his name as they kind of broadcast us on the evening news, which was nice. And but yeah, we've had a fair amount. I mean, like, it's tricky. Like, we kind of learn fairly early on, you know, that you have to, you know, we kind of to pick certain reporters that we like and kind of, you know, and work with them. Although we were once in Front magazine, which is quite amazing. So it was like Jordan's tits, Space Hijackers, Jodie Marsh, you know, and it was like, which I thought was quite beautiful because, like, those, you know, the kind of the average readership of Front magazine would probably never find out about us otherwise. So I thought that was good.
I think we're gonna have to wrap up now. But I'm gonna ask my own question. But are you interested in doing more of this sort of media hacking thing, like the Yes Men? If you've come across,
who will
readily impersonate corporate spokespeople?
We met them the other day, and we were. We're talking about possibly starting to do things together, so that could be funny.
Look out for that. And will you be around the rest of the day?
I'm kind of off to Pride in a bit, okay. But then I might pop back later or something. We'll see how it goes.
And people can find out more about you on your website.
Yes, which is spacehijackers.org.
In fact, if someone touches the screen there, it'll appear. Oh yeah,
no,
or something will appear. Thank you very much, Bristly Pioneer. For the next part of this very double bill, we've got someone who's been going through rather more official channels, and she's a London-based journalist and author, and I hope isn't lost on the stairs, and she was instrumental in getting MPs' expenses disclosed. Please welcome Heather Brooke.
Hello. I'm just going to speak to you, so I don't know. We don't need that.
But, I don't know. Do you like the light?
The light is okay.
Do people prefer this light or just no projector? Can you unplug the projector?
How many tech people does it take to turn off a projector?
Just take it out of the. Good.
Great. Well, so my name's Heather Brooke, and I'm going to talk today, well, just at this session, mostly about getting MPs' expense receipts into the public domain using Freedom of Information. I'm also going to be one of the people at a Freedom of Information workshop at 2:00, where it's more of a hands-on thing, where if you have your own Freedom of Information requests or ideas to make your own requests, ask questions, then you can come along to that. I don't know where it is.
It's in one of the other rooms here, yes. But there's only three, so you should be able to find it.
The fourth room, apparently, yes. But I don't know how much background you know about this, but I was profiled in The Guardian about my story, and so I'll sort of expand on that as far as using Freedom of Information. Does it work? Well, it used to be that I would say it didn't work very well, but with the whole MPs expense campaign, I think we're in this amazing time in Britain right now where we have the moral high ground, and anybody who wants to make Freedom of Information requests, there really couldn't be a better time to do it than right now, because any politician, anybody working in a public body, if they refuse a request right now, that they feel under pressure and they sort of worry about their opinion. Is it going to get in the news? Will it be a huge PR disaster like the House of Commons? So I've started to see a much more receptive audience from different public officials, and I'm sure Francis will talk about overall across all public bodies how requests have been answered, because he's one of the people that runs the whatdotheyknow.com website, which is an online freedom of information filer and archive. When I first took on the House of Commons, I wasn't doing it to bring down the government at all. It wasn't my intention. I was writing my book, Your Right to Know, and I just went through all types of different public bodies. I did central government, I did local government, I did the police, I did the courts, I did all sorts of things. And I talked about ways that I saw freedom of information working for the people, so that whatever public body you came into contact with, these are some of the requests I thought were worth making. And when I came to Parliament, I started studying the way MPs were paid, and I found this whole list of different types of allowances. So there was the staffing allowance, there was the additional costs allowance, which dealt with their second homes. There was a stationary allowance, and it just sort of went on. And none of that was, you knew what they could claim, what the maximum was, but you didn't actually know, this is in 2003 when I was starting my book, you didn't actually know how much these MPs were claiming. And they were pretty substantial amounts. They were basically 2 to 3 times their basic wage. So it seemed to me that was an area of great opacity, that the public were giving all this money to MPs and we had no real accountability about how it was spent. And whenever I see a situation like that where somebody has money which is seen to be free money, it's not their money, they're not getting it out of their own pocket, it's coming to them from the public, and there's no scrutiny and no accountability, that's just generally, as a rule of thumb, a recipe for corruption and disaster and abuse. So even I thought, for their own benefit, that they should have to account in more detail about how that was spent, just so that those MPs who were abiding by the rules, who were working in the public interest, would be shown to be doing that and be rewarded by their constituents for the fact that they were upstanding, professional, gave the citizen value for money. They would be rewarded and highlighted, and anybody who needed secrecy to do their shady deals or were in Parliament for their own interest rather than to serve the public interest, well, those people too would be exposed, and then they would be cleared out of Parliament, which would leave room for better people to come into office. So I'm not the sort of journalist who is just looking to have a head on a plate, which is generally what a lot of journalists are after, is they just want people to resign. And although I am actually quite pleased that the Speaker had to resign, I've got to say, and I'll tell you a bit why in particular he did need to resign. But really it was just about the system and the institution, and I thought it needed reforming. It was woefully out of date. I didn't think it was democratic in any way. And particularly about the amounts of money they were spending in that MPs would allocate to huge projects, whether it be the Ministry of Defence or these big giant database systems or the ID card. The fact that they could spend so much money and not really be accountable for it, I thought that really began at home in their own office, and their attitude about just kind of spending in a profligate way and not thinking that the public deserved a detailed account of where it went, why, what were the reasons behind the spending. I wanted to get to the bottom of it. So I first called up, I made a telephone call to the switchboard, and that, I don't know if you've ever called a switchboard of a big bureaucratic institution, it's never fun, and you just kind of go around and people sort of send you on a little goose chase. So I was asking them, who's in charge of freedom of information? So this was in 2004, Well, the Freedom of Information Act was actually passed in 2000, and Britain had, amongst all countries in the world, the longest preparation time to implement this law. They had 5 years, because the law didn't actually come into force until January 2005. And they claimed that they needed 5 years because transparency was obviously so revolutionary to British institutions that they had to have that long to, you know, get to grips with it. And some people say that's when all the shredders started firing up and they needed, you know, 5 years to sort of shred all the incriminating documents. I don't know if that's true. But either way, by 2004, you would have thought they would be well on their way to getting everything ready. But in fact, what I found is that they still hadn't really even begun to prepare. A lot of public bodies didn't even have freedom of information officers. If you called up to ask, you know, well, what are you going to do when January 2005 hits? What are you going to publish proactively? They weren't going to publish anything proactively, really. And when finally they had to do so, they would just do minimum things like an organogram of the department or something like that. So when I did find the Freedom of Information person at Parliament, I asked them about what about MPs' expenses? Are you going to make those receipts public? And there was this kind of, what? This sort of shocked and bemused response. That I don't even think they really understood what I was asking. They just couldn't get to grips with, I suppose they thought, my arrogance, that I would even deign to think that me, some sort of plebeian person, would have the temerity to kind of ask to see an honorable member's receipts. Anyway, I pressed on and I said, well, yeah, that's what I want. And they said, oh, well, we'll get back to you. And so they did. And they said, we've decided that we're going to publish the allowances in October 2004, and it will be the first ever. It's a revolutionary step of Parliament. It's the new age of transparency, blah, blah, blah. So when October came, they did publish information, and at that time what it was a listing of every MP and then the bulk totals in each type of allowance. So it would say, this is how much Alan Keane spent on staffing allowance, this is how much whoever else spent on second homes. But that was it, it was just a figure. And it didn't in any way, I mean, it was a first step, but it certainly didn't give me any confidence that it was being spent correctly, because that's the real beauty of freedom of information, is it allows you to get right into the detail of data. And as an investigator, the only way you can ever get to the truth is through detail. That's always how people are caught out, you know, lying in any kind of corruption case. You've got to get this detail. So as soon as you see that detailed information is being aggregated in such a way that it becomes anonymized, instantly I would get kind of suspicious about that and think, well, why have they done that? Sometimes there might be legitimate reasons, but in this case, I didn't think there was. So that was, my antenna went up, and I thought, why are they aggregating this data? Why don't they just do what I asked in the first place and give an account of all the receipts? And I'd seen this before because I used to work as a reporter in America, and I was an intern in Washington State, and this was in 1992, so a long time ago. And an editor had suggested, why don't you go have a look at our politicians' expense claims? So I went to the clerk's office at the state legislature and said, I'd like to see these claims for my politicians. The clerk said, okay. They got these big boxes out. They were filled with all receipts. I mean, not particularly well ordered, but they were all there, all the receipts of airline tickets, hotel bills, everything they'd ordered on room service, all the stationery, all the postage, everything. Every receipt was there. And it was considered a public record, so it wasn't just the fact that I was a reporter, I could see it. Any member of the public could have looked up their politicians' expense receipts. So I looked through it all, very excited. Oh, I'm going to get the biggest story of the century. I'm going to bring down the Washington government, blah. And I found not one single incorrect claim. They were all totally above board. There was no questionable claims of any kind. And that taught me, I think, the real lesson of transparency and why it's such an efficient way to run any public system, because you don't have to have an outside regulator. You just let the public be the regulator, and as long as all the politicians knew that the public could at any time look at those records, that was enough to keep them honest. I don't think they were better people. I don't think particularly MPs are bad people. I just think the way the system was organized, every incentive was there for them to personally enrich themselves. So that's sort of why I became really interested in transparency, and that's also why I wasn't happy when I got these, when I saw in 2004 these aggregate figures of MPs' expense claims. So when January 2005 came, I started making formal written requests under the Freedom of Information Act, and I asked for different types of a breakdown by receipt of different types of claim. So I asked for travel, that was rejected. I asked for the names and salaries of MP staff, because it was rumored around Westminster Village that a lot of MPs employed their staff, and not all of them were doing any work. But the only way you could see if that rumor was true was to know the names of the staff and how much they were paid. Because it's fine, maybe somebody wants to employ their family, and maybe that's fine, and maybe they work as a volunteer, but if they are getting a full salary and you happen to know that, for example, they're a full-time student, or as in Derek Conway's case, the only way you can find it, the only way you can prove that, the evidence you need is the name and the salary of the staff member. So I made that request, and this is my first run-in with the speaker. So Speaker Michael Martin signed a certificate, which is in the law. When the speaker signs a certificate, it's considered conclusive proof that information is absolutely exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. So he signed this certificate about the names and salaries of MP staff. Again, instantly made me very suspicious that something was going on there. But there was no way for me to appeal that, unless I did a judicial review possibly, but I couldn't see, I asked some lawyers and I couldn't find a way to appeal that. So I just had to let that drop. And then it was a few months, I think it was the following year, that the Derek Conway scandal broke. And then we saw why that had been suppressed. And I should say that it's still the case that you can't find out the names and salaries of MP staff. It's still secret. So there's some voluntary registers, but and I think now there's a mandatory, I'm not quite sure, but there is a list of relatives that are employed, but you don't know what they're being paid, and that's really quite crucial. So that was my second one. And then I tried a third time, and this third time was indeed lucky. So I asked for the second homes allowance, because again, it was a rumor that these second homes allowances were being abused pretty spectacularly. But again, and this is the problem in so much of political life, everything was talked about as rumor, innuendo. You never knew the truth of it. You didn't know where the information was coming from. You didn't know its validity. And I really wanted to know, well, is that true? Is it not true? The only way to find out is to get a breakdown by receipt of the second homes allowances and see if they're claiming for a mortgage, do they actually have a mortgage? If they're claiming that they have a second home, are they actually living in it? Do they rent it out to somebody else but pocket all the taxpayer subsidy? So I put that in and I waited. And this is the biggest problem with Freedom of Information at the moment, is there is this big problem of delay. So my request sat with the Information Commissioner, who is the outside regulator of the law, for about a year. I think it was about a year and 3 months. And during that time, there were several other journalists who'd made requests about second home allowances. And they had requests about a couple of MPs from the beginning of 2005. And the Commissioner didn't actually make his decision until August 2007. So in almost 2.5 years, that's how long it took from the time the first people made the request to the decision coming through. The whole way through, it was unhelpfulness, obstruction from the House of Commons. So I had asked, I'd like the second homes receipts for all MPs, and they just instantly rejected that request and said, it will cost us too much to supply that information, so we reject it. My big advice to anybody who wants to make a request, within the law there's a section that puts on the public body a duty to provide advice and assistance. So what the Commons should have done is said to me, well, look, it's going to cost too much to provide you with 646 MPs receipts, but here's how many MPs you can get for your money, you know, 10, 20, 100, 50, whatever. But they never did that. And even until a few months ago, they still were not doing that. They would just reject your request. They would not offer to negotiate with you or anything. So the commissioner had said, went back to the House of Commons and said, well, you need to talk to Heather and see if you can't answer all, if you can't give her the information for all MPs, how many can you give her? And they told me 10. That was how much they could afford to do. So I put in my 10, and I waited for the commissioner. I put in my 10, and then the House of Commons said, well, we're still rejecting it anyway, and here's new reasons we found to reject it. So the big one was about security and privacy. So that was the root of the Commons argument, that it was an invasion of MPs' privacy for the public to know how these public officials had spent public money in the course of their official parliamentary duties, which is just an untenable argument. So I appealed it. I went back to the commissioner. I said, well, I want you to review this rejection of my request. He did decide, but what he did was he made this sort of compromise where he said, well, I agree that they haven't given you enough information, but I don't agree that they should have to provide receipts because I do think it's an invasion of their privacy. So he came up with a kind of halfway house that didn't please anybody. So the House of Commons appealed because they thought they would have to give out too much, and I appealed because I thought they didn't give out enough. So we all appealed. Well, okay. So then I have to go to the Information Tribunal, which is a kind of quasi-court, and anybody can go, you don't need a lawyer, but when you're up against a big institution like the House of Commons, they came with about 5 lawyers. So I did feel like I wanted to have a lawyer there. Unfortunately, I found a QC who was willing to work pro bono for me, a really good one, Hugh Tomlinson. And It was his cross-examination of Andrew Walker, the head of the fees office, that for the first time really exposed what was going on in the House of Commons. The fact that MPs were allowed to write their own checks, that they would just say, oh, you know, I want this, and they would generally get it. And receipts didn't have to be provided for anything less than £250. And then we found out there was this food rule, which was £400 they could claim without providing any receipts. And so Hugh asked, well, is that £400 a month, a quarter, a year? And Andrew Walker didn't know. And he's the head of the fees office in charge. He said, well, I'll have to get back to you. And we thought, well, if this is the person that's meant to be running the fees office, it didn't really bode well for the whole way it was run. And we discovered there was only five staff running it. They never audited the receipts, so they basically just took it on word. And when we questioned him about this, he said, we said, well, how do you know that these claims are actually legitimate? And they said, well, if we see a receipt, we assume it's reasonable, and it's within, that it's a reasonable claim. These are honorable members. And that was definitely, that was the attitude. And the other great quote, which I always like to quote, that he said in the tribunal was that transparency was bad for democracy, which I just, and I still think there is a sort of underlying belief within a lot of public institutions that do you think that transparency damages democracy? Well, we won that case, and we thought that was the end of it. However, we then discovered that the speaker was going to appeal the tribunal's decision. His own legal team advised him against doing this. They said, "We don't, you know, we've lost pretty substantially. We don't think we're going to win in the High Court." And so he got rid of that legal team, and he went shopping for a new one. And he got another lawyer who agreed that he could try and find a case, a way they could appeal to the High Court. So we went to the High Court. In the High Court, costs are always awarded, so that then I was faced with, because up till then it was all, I didn't have to pay anything out. But if you go to the High Court, you know, I could have been awarded, like, you know, if I lost, I could have lost up to like £300,000 plus. So that's when, again, it was worth having lawyers, because what they did, they found a way for me to go under a conditional fee agreement, and then I had legal insurance so that if I did lose, I wouldn't be personally bankrupted. But if I won, the lawyers would go for costs against the House of Commons. We did win. They lost, I think they lost quite a substantial amount of money, about £200,000. So not only did the House of Commons waste all this money fighting against information that should have always been in the public domain, but they then also lost in costs. Sadly, I didn't see any of that cost. I went to the lawyers, but but hopefully, I think that does make them think twice about fighting these cases again. And just to conclude, once that High Court victory came out, that's when the House of Commons said, we're going to publish all receipts for all MPs for the last 4 years, and we'll do that by October 2008. And that's when the whole operation of scanning all these documents started up. And in fact, they were all scanned in by October 2008. But then what happened behind the scenes is that they began redacting information, not in line with the High Court ruling, but just things they didn't think the public ought to know. And this is what really added to the cost, because every time you have to delete something from a record or black it out, that's an extra cost, and it means somebody has to go through every single record. So they kept delaying that publication, and it was in that delay that one of the people who was involved in the scanning in, who I assume had read the information and was outraged by it, as it became clear that the House of Commons was not going to publish it as it had said, as it had promised, that's when the person went and leaked it. And that's how we have the Daily Telegraph story.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks for that. I think we have some time for. I mean, you're doing this workshop later on, so people will be able to ask you questions during the day. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask in this forum particularly? They're at the front. How are you funded?
Well, good question. I'm an investigative journalist / writer / teacher / conference speaker. And I think this is the only way to do it, is that you have to do quite a lot of things, because to do investigative journalism now is not very well funded. So I do a number of different, I teach, I speak, I write articles. I think what's sad in our journalistic climate at the moment is that I generally always get paid more the fewer facts I have in a story. So if I have a very like intense investigative story, like the House of Commons thing, I mean, journalistically that is not a value for money proposition. But that's not why I did it. I did it as a campaigner, really. And I think that it will make journalism, the type that I want to do, easier in future, because now we have this whole class of information which is released, and now we can go to other public bodies and say, look, you need to release this information too, because the Commons has done it.
Do we have more questions? I'm just going to ask briefly here, Alistair, have you seen any of the speakers for the next session? I know we've got Louise here, but if not, we'll just keep doing Q&As.
Have can you have a quick look round? Thank you. Sorry. A question there at the front. Oh, you
What's your next target? I mean, do you think are there more secrets? Like, I mean, would if you'd like to share that at this stage, what would you like to see be revealed?
Well, I don't think I've won in the House of Commons because the victory is there as far as the rhetoric goes. So no politician is ever going to come out now, or civil servant, and say transparency is bad for democracy. You know, that's just never going to happen now. So it's great that they all use the right rhetoric, and even Gordon Brown is like, oh, I'm totally into transparency. But where it fails is like, then the next day he'll go and say, oh yeah, but I'm having the Iraq war inquiry in secret. So the rhetoric is there, but the action hasn't followed on yet. Not at all. So I still think there is work to be done as far as opening up Parliament to the people and actually getting information out of it. But there's plenty of other organizations. A lot of people say, oh, are you going to take on the EU next? No, thanks. Somebody else can fight that battle. What I like to do is I like to open things up and then let other people do what interests them. I guess my other main interest is the police. So that's, I like to sort of have a little dig around there.
You could team up with Robin and the Yes Men. Who knows where that would lead. Another question. I'm picking them for the front because then I can hear them.
Yeah, I probably will do that in the workshop because it's quite involved about how do you deal with the exemptions in the law, like commercial confidentiality and the way public services are privatized, and how do you get information when that happens. There are ways, certainly. But the main rule with all these things is that you want to have the public interest in your favor, and that's the leverage you use to get information out, is that you have to be able to say it's in the public interest.
Fantastic. Any really quick questions? So I get the impression that other sessions are starting. Go on, if it's really quick.
Just one question about the adaption. You said that it's kind of the
I don't know if it's going to change. What they've done is they've redacted all the fees office communication, which is where we saw Douglas, that's the whole sort of Douglas Hogg getting his moat cleaned. The reason we know about all that is from communications between the MP and the fees office, and that was all redacted and in some cases just deleted from the public record. But what I've heard is that they aren't going to they've already published their official version, and if people want the less redacted version, then they'll have to make a Freedom of Information request.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time. As you said, your workshop is at 2 o'clock.
Yes, 2 o'clock.
Two o'clock. Thank you very much. And I think we're now having a short break, where you can go to digital engagement, which is presumably upstairs, and some other things about the internet.